Welcome to ZMO Kitchen Talks, a podcast about historical and anthropological research in the Middle East, Africa, Eurasia, South and Southeast Asia, produced by Leibniz Zentrum Moderner Orient in Berlin. My name is Elisa Nobel-Dilati. I'm a Middle East anthropologist and knowledge transfer officer at ZMO. Over a cup of coffee or tea, I talk to renowned academics about their research questions, regions, and methodologies. We also take a look behind the scenes of academic practice at personal reflections, challenges, failures, and unexpected outcomes. Welcome to a new episode of ZMO Kitchen Talks. I'm very happy that my guest today is Sana Shavoshian. Sana, thank you for coming.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let me just briefly introduce you to our listeners. Dr. Sana Shavoshian is an anthropologist working for several years on war environments in Iran and more recently in Iraq. Before joining ZMO in 2021, she was a junior researcher at the Center for Advanced Studies, Multiple Secularities in Leipzig for 5 years, and currently holds a fellowship at Käthe Hamburger Kolleg Practices of Repair at the University of Saarland. Her engagement with the notions of war ecology, repair and resistance started during her PhD, when she was working on Iranian mothers of fallen soldiers and the way they invoke their loss and the absence of their sons in various rituals and spaces of commemoration. Her book, Women, Martyrs and Stones in Iran's Post-War Politics, will appear in early 2025 by Edinburgh University Press. And in her current project on dust winds, Sana deals with experiencing bad air caused by recurrent wars and climate change over the Mesopotamian marshlands in the southern borders of Iraq and Iran. So starting with that recent project of yours, I will start with a very simple question. Why dust? And could something like dust be studied at all, and particularly by an anthropologist?
Why dust? I mean, you might ask this because it is overpresent or because we try not to attend certain objects when they are visible and invisible. Dust's characteristic actually is being located between this invisibility and visibility. You can feel it between the touch of your fingers, and you can think about many things afterwards. Oblivion, forgetfulness, dirt, the need to do another round of hoovering around the house. We are all the time dealing with dust. In our homes, when we go to museums, we fight against it. We clean it from the windows. So, I mean, the work of an anthropologist is being engaged with normal practices of everyday life. And dust is one of those practices, we want it or not. Also, ontologically thinking about it, dust is not itself. It is many things at the same time. It can be a combination of sand, hair, pollen, and that has kept many philosophers for many years away from it. Even those who have been thinking about elements never wanted to attend to dust. Recently, there has been more concentrations with meteorological ways of understanding dust that says, okay, something like dust wind can differ, sand winds, because it can suspend. It's not that wayful to sit down, to settle. And all these combinations that might happen in an electromagnetic field or in the air or on the level that might happen with us and through us and go to our lungs through breathing are things that makes it, for me and for anthropologists, interesting to think through dust. Whether there are other ways than of thinking about dust that might be engaging for people other than anthropologists, but still scholarly and scientifically, I cannot skip this, that I myself have always liked to watch these YouTube videos of museum workers with a small pad in their hands when they try to take that darker layer away from the surface of a painting, and suddenly it comes with its shine and its lure back. How smoothing, soothing, easing, satisfying such an experience can be. People use it all the time for relaxation. There are plenty of videos on it on YouTube that you can watch with different objects by archaeologists doing that. Or it's the discovery always starts with rubbing away the dust, putting it off from something, and the treasure comes out of the dust. It doesn't bring dust into the state of the non-importance. Actually, it sets it forward as something very important. So also thinking about historians, thinking about wars, dust has been important. Regionally speaking, in the Middle East, people who wanted to make the first maps over the Mesopotamian region and over the marshlands and over in Iraq especially by the British colonializers, they tried to map regions that were affected by and impacted by sand winds and also by very thick dust. On walking, they couldn't enter. By flights, between like short before the World War One and before between 1912 and 1915, there were several attempts, airplanes going and trying to take photos from this region in order to use it for making the maps, the first maps of Shatt al-Arab. And this was never working because of the very heavy wind that was breaking those small plates that were supposed to do the photography. So historically, dust started its presence in that region where I today work with the story of a challenge with an object that was a micro object, but it was present. It was a part of the history. And I think it's for historians today, it's also a question how to look at objects that they have not have been thinking before, and also in different versions of materiality studies, like material religion that I used to work on, and you mentioned the book, and also on historical materialities, weathers, climate, Anthropocene, in all these modes of thinking, anthropologically and historically, dust has been present.
Mm, thank you. Now, speaking about your field research, you conducted extensive field research in Shatt al-Arab in the at the border of Iran and Iraq, and you studied dust in connection with the sanctions on Iran. What's the connection between the two themes?
Well, I have been always taken by these questions that put political matters into everyday matters of life, and how people would grieve things that it seems as if it is taken away from them by sovereign forces, by violence, by atrocities. So I could never see these matters separate from one another. And as much as we can think about recurrent wars, on, especially on that borderlands, and more specifically in Iraq, since the 1980s, first Gulf Wars, Iran-Iraq War, the US invasion, and a later situation, then come along decades-long sanctions. It fell over Iran, especially since the time since 1980, the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War, and afterwards, and it is also very present in Iran until today, after the declaration of the dangers of the nuclear programs of Iran. And it has been sometimes UN set ones, and sometimes the American ones, sometimes the European ones, the Western ones. And also in Iraq, they have turned into a field of a study of what are the consequences of sanctions since the 1980s and 90s, particularly the 90s, that some sort of harshest sanctions in medical sector and also in environmentally involved matters came and overtook Iraq to an extent that a country, a state, went to its knees. It was supposed to be harsh, but it the collateral damage sounded to be more than what was expected from them. And so I think that while I don't want to enter this field of what is the distinction between sanction and a smart sanction, something that might interest political scientists, I still think that thinking through sanctions is talking about a historical fact of that region that has engaged certain lives, that has engaged the environment, and has engaged hospitals, medical sector, women, and generationally, children of next generation. We can think about antibiotic. We can think about the soil not being powerful enough because it has not been fed. We can think about water scarcity. These are things that are known today, had happened during that two-decade-long sanction between Iran and Iraq. And the new range of climate change and all these water policies between Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran is somehow entangled into that. And that's why I thought it might be an interesting way to think about sanction and dust winds that in Iran, at least since 2014-15, is taking over the region as a new phenomenon. And the way that people speak about it. I mean, I'm not trying to make a causal relation and say that they put the sanction and then came the dust winds. Yeah, such ways of thinking are not valid historically nor anthropologically. But we can see today that in order to express themselves, the locals, the inhabitants, use the language of sanction as a way to talk about poverty, as a way to talk about precarity, as a way to talk about being deprived of something. And I think it is a very valid expression to keep it with the inhabitants of Khuzestan, the Iranian province on the top of Shatt al-Arab, when they would say, poverty is not having air to breathe. And the dust wind is that state that when it takes over a region over days and stays there, it suspends all over there, covers the region. It is that state of suffocation, of airlessness that brings people to breathe the sanctions or the former wars with all those suspicious ways of thinking, what is this wind bringing us? Is it bringing us something from the other people's sanction, the Iraqis, with all those pollutions? Or is it only a normal wind? And such things like can happen in every brain, I mean, every individual who is a little bit aware of the history of that region. Chemical bombings, what Saddam Hussein was using against the former Arab inhabitants of the marshlands, what has been used during the war, what are the burn pits and the Americans used, what was the nature of those bombs fallen from the British aircrafts. Then we can allow ourselves to think about those winds as suspicious winds.
Mm-hmm. How do politics, especially politics of war and meteorology, come together in your study?
I think part of it I have answered about my own study, but I'm not definitely the only person who works on the relation between politics and meteorology. Since this turn to space in social sciences and humanities, known as the spatial turn, and the material turn, matters of atmosphere and how they impact bodies of human beings and also the multi-species has been of question. Meteorology here matters not only on the level of everyday weather, which then the question would be how environmental policies are made for day-by-day lives of people, in regions that are influenced, for example, by very high level of drought, but it is also into pollution studies, air pollution studies. And given that this sort of subjectivity we know today as breathers is a very important factor also into the movements like Black Lives Matter, then we can say that politics and meteorology, or politics and air, has gone very well from our lungs to the air, to the clouds, to the atmosphere and the higher atmosphere, interrelated with one another.
So far, impacts of economic sanctions are rather scarcely studied. So I'm wondering, which aspects are you bringing to the fore through your approach?
Well, I'm not a specialist of sanction studies, but I think it is a very important field that is speaking to many regions of the world and also about many people. I'm also somehow sympathetic to the new studies that say sanctions can be a new mode of war. So, and on that level, as a person who has been always interested to study ecologies of war, I might be interested to talk about ecologies of sanctions or ecologies of resistance, of those who need to, in each inhale and exhale, imagine themselves as fighting the sanctions. That's how it comes to my work. Also, you know, on the border province in Iran where I work, there are regions assigned by the Ministry of Environment as combat dust zones. So it's not only a simple policy for environment to grow more trees, to preserve water resources, or, I don't know, to make tunnels of air or make a sort of huge, huge fences not to take the winds from Iraq. But it's also a way of thinking when you say that a dust zone or a region or a zone which is impacted by dust is a combat zone, especially in the mind of those who had experienced the Iran-Iraq war and are very familiar with this kind of war and combat culture. So it is a discourse that used to be present there, and all its reverberations, all its resonances in material and language forms are coming until today. And it's also making sense to those people who know themselves as those like who had experienced movement through war, escaping from war, returning back to the debris of war. And now this is their new level of war and resistance. Once upon a time, there was invasion by human forces. Now it is invasion by air. And this is how the state and the formalities and the language of the politics want people to understand sanctions. This air, this bad quality of living that you're experiencing is because of the sanctions. And I'm not saying that people are just eating it up and not challenging it. What I mean is that they are also cynical and strategic enough to know that in order to negotiate anything back with the state in Iran, they need to refer to sanctions. Because no other language in a region which is influenced by not only regional and translocal politics, but also with the question of Arab and the non-Arab, or Arab radical activist group, or separationist, or recurrent wars in the region, it can be geopolitically and strategically very important how you frame your claim for a basic matter of life, namely breathing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super interesting, actually. I'm wondering, is your fieldwork limited to the incidences of dust winds, or where else do you follow such a broad and at the same time micro theme as dust?
Well, it was good that you mentioned dust wind, because while I whenever I try to talk about it for a matter of simplification or making myself understood, I separate dust from the wind. Dust wind in itself is a phenomenon. It has its own phenomenology. It has its own movement, unlike dust that we know as a settled object that we need to move with our hand. Dust wind moves by itself. It is dependent on the movement of air. It is cyclic. It has its own cycle. It has, it is a seasonal thing. And it can also happen in regions that are unexpected to us, move with the clouds or take the shape of a haze. So on that level, I need to rethink how I would be able to talk about dust winds, which is not reduced to dust or wind. That is one matter. And the other thing that was also a part of your question, where else it could be studied. I think if we could think about all these coming together, entanglements of the micro matters, not only on the level of land and in farming matters that has been so far the field that I have studies, like in the combat dust zones, but also like in the seas or in the air itself or in border studies. I know from one study done by the anthropologist Jerry Z, Continent in Dust. Actually, in the last chapter, he talks about dust wind as a new version of something that used to be extincted. He says that the dust winds are doing on top of the oceans what used to be done by the whales. Those whales, hundreds of years ago, got extincted and could not bring enough phytoplanktons that was carried through their bodies and as their food from China, northwise. But he says that now the dust wind is doing the same job because it can carry different particles. And as far as we don't know what it is carrying, we don't know what its power is and how it is changing the climate, how it is changing the earth and the universe.
Yeah, there has been an international awareness and policy makings about transitional justice and reparational politics in post-war contexts. How does your work contribute to them?
Well, specifically, it would relate to the question of reparational policies with regard to the Mesopotamian marshlands. Not only because since the US invasion on Iraq and going of Saddam Hussein to the court, which was the first time somebody was publicly and legally condemned for ecocide, which was killing the marshland, drawing the marshlands on purpose in order to move or push back those so-called partisans, namely the Arabs of the marsh, from the region. How to repair the marshlands that are being influenced by the general climate change and also by willful attempts? They are very important resources. Under the marshlands are lots of beds of oil. So both countries and also internationally, there is an interest. We are still living in carbon democracy. Oil still matters. And this is the most important part of the geopolitics of the Middle East. Oil is the question and where it is. So any practice of repair and any practice of thinking about transitional justice is unavoidably interwoven to the question of the marshlands, and extracting oil from them means also extraction of the marshlands themselves. Should it be done through drawing them, or should they be rehabilitated, revived? These has been questions since at least 2012 for Iraq. Unfortunately, it hasn't been that much in Iran. First of all, because the situation with the water, the level of water was much better on the side of the marshlands in Iran. Second, because Iran had its own policies of oil extraction from this region. But I think this is definitely important for the future of the marshlands, how they want to preserve the marshlands and for whom, whether they are using it as a seal or whether they are using it as an ecosystem with all those beautiful birds. Oh, you don't know the number of birds that would come in spring over that region. It's not only flamingos. The marshlands has even their own species of animals, and it can be heavenly beautiful. It's associated actually since years as the Garden of Eden. This is the name that we know for Mesopotamian marshlands. And imagining them as a dead piece of dried land, I think locally and internationally, nobody wants it to happen.
Mm. Yeah, connecting to that, a final question. What do you think are the future perspectives for the Khuzestan region, for Shatt al-Arab specifically, in economic and environmental terms?
That's an interesting question. As an anthropologist doing field work right now, being also in the middle of my field work, I barely think about future. But I think it's also a character of coming from the Middle East and doing field work in the Middle East. What is the future? How long it is? On the other hand, I remember the first time that I was trying to make myself more familiar with the new field, namely Iraq and specifically Basra. I searched it on internet like a tourist, and there were beautiful comparisons with a very famous city, Venice. The Venice of Iraq, well, it wasn't an exaggeration. There are boats as beautiful as that all over on the crosses of Euphrates and Kerche on the Iran side and Arvand on Iran side, and generally in Shatt al-Arab. But thinking about a region which is known with such a level of resistance, Basra, and all those material debris and atrocities that it has gone through. My first picture of Basra was destruction. It was broken pieces of cement everywhere. It was literally going into dust and remain of deconstructions until my knee, and I'm not exaggerating that, and garbage. So it is very far from that imagination of Venice. Like every developing place over the Persian Gulf and in Shatt al-Arab, there are urbanizations, gentrifications, big malls that are made there. But like 10 steps away from it, 100 meters away, life is something else. And still, like, the city is not even connected totally for the number of construction projects. It's mad. It's just like everywhere they're making one bridge here, another road there, and none of them are completed. This one is done by an Italian company. This one is done by a British company. This one is done by Iraq itself. And yet you cannot walk as a pedestrian. You have no right to walk in Basra. My sense of working, even if I was only a tourist, forgetting about being a geographer, historian, a person who needs to use an archive, is through sensing a city through walking. Then I can say what it would look like in 10 years. What I have seen so far on the Iraqi side was this huge air conditioners with fans. Yeah, they are fancy, because over the border in Iran, this object is a scarcity. Is a scarcity. We don't have it there. And everywhere else is. No asphalt. No urban life. Not that much women presence. And that was very hard for me. Not to see women outside. And on the Iranian side, thinking about a future comes when you can think about an oil-rich region together with an environment of living. Other than certain very small portion of the region, namely Abadan itself, the rest are not only still filled with the debris and not constructed, but also now covered by this haze and dust that makes it like a living museum that nobody had time to clean up.
Yeah, thank you for sharing all of these insights and thoughts with us, Sana.
I hope I haven't been so apocalyptic and negative at the end of the day. It's a very interesting region.
Yeah. Is there a positive note we can close with?
The positive note might be that climate change is happening and we are living in a more connected world than the one we might think of. We might be as multi and as friendly and as invisible as dust is. Sometimes it is bewitched if we could move as freely as dust.